Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winicky and I'm the Community Engagement Coordinator at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. I would now like to introduce Vice Chancellor Michael Haney to introduce this morning's speaker.
Thank you, Emily. And thanks to everyone who is joining us today on what is a snowy spring Syracuse morning for the Thursday Morning Roundtable. This morning, it is my great pleasure and great honor to welcome and introduce today's speaker, New York State Assembly Member Pamela Hunter. Assembly Member Hunter is a native of upstate New York and someone who, long before she was elected, had dedicated herself to a life of service before self. Pam is a veteran of the United States Army. In fact, she is the only female veteran serving in the New York State Legislature. And as an aside, I have to say that I think that fact, Pam and I both agree, is not one to be celebrated, but instead one to be positioned as a cause for future action. But Assembly Member Hunter serves as the chair of the Assembly Subcommittee on Women Veterans. She works tirelessly to expand benefits and services and improve opportunities for the great many women who have served this country in uniform. She also serves on the Energy, Insurance, Social Services, Transportation, and Veterans Affairs Committees, and is a member of the Black and Puerto Rican Legislators and Women's Caucuses. Pam will share a bit more about her background and life experiences during her talk, so I won't take up any additional time on that front, but I do want to conclude my introduction by saying thank you to Assembly Member Hunter. Thank you for your passion, your commitment to building a better future for Central New York. Thank you for your clear focus on good jobs, improved schools, community-situated public safety, and for your efforts to help others understand how those outcomes correlate directly to enhanced quality of life and a stronger Central New York community. So with that, on behalf of Syracuse University and Thursday Morning Roundtable, please join me in welcoming Assembly Member Pamela Hunter. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Good morning, everyone, virtually. It's great to virtually see everyone. This has been my life. As you can see, I have glasses on. Many times I spend so much time on Zoom that people know actually where I am based on the glasses I have on because I have them everywhere so I can make sure that I can see. I think with this digital space that we live in, unfortunately, the screen time has affected my eyesight. So I'm going to jump right in just to go a little bit more over my bio and then get right to some of the work that I've been able to accomplish since being elected. Mike is right. I did grow up in upstate New York, Lake Luzerne, that is right between Lake George and Saratoga for all of you native New Yorkers. And I am an Army veteran. I do have a bachelor's degree, graduated from Washington, D.C. And I would say most of the folks who I saw are participants I know, which is awesome, but I do represent the 128th Assembly District, which encompasses the town of Salina, Onondaga, DeWitt, and the Onondaga Nation, which also includes the south side and east side of the city of Syracuse. So I do have actually one of the most diverse districts across the state because it includes the Onondaga Nation. Next slide, please. Before I was in the assembly elected in 2015, I did serve on the Syracuse Common Council for 3 years, not consecutively, but I was the Public Safety Committee Chair for the council all 3 years. And many of you know my work in the community, serving on various community boards. And some of you are here today, actually, that I see, having served on the boards of Access CNY and Catholic Charities, Meals on Wheels. Many of you have seen me out there delivering the meals and Homemades of Central New York, which was a huge passion of mine, as Homemades were just essential for my mother when she, at her end of life, and they just are a great organization. Next slide, please. I do chair the majority conference that is in the leadership. I was assigned to that position this year. And it's been an interesting year leading a lot of different diverse voices in the assembly this year. And being the only female veteran of 150 assembly members and 63 senators is interesting because you would think of 19 million people plus in the state of New York, there'd be more than just me, but that is true. It's just me representing as the only female veteran. And additionally, I was making mention before we started, nationally, I do chair the Health and Long-Term Care Committee for the National Council Conference of Insurance Legislators, NCOIL, which is interesting because we're able to create model laws that each individual legislator across the nation can bring back to their prospective states. Next slide, please. Many people know that a lot of the pieces of legislation that I introduce actually come from people who visit my office, sit in my office and say, we have this issue, that there's a problem, and I'm going to go over some of those here with you this morning. I'll always continue to advocate for those who need the help the most. We do have a significant equity wealth divide in this community, and hopefully with some of the pieces of legislation I was able to introduce, we'll be able to make that gap a little bit smaller. So let's get into some of the legislation that I've been able to craft and pass since I've been elected. And I broke them up based on the different kind of categories. So the first one is relative to criminal justice reform and economic justice. So many of you may have heard in the news, you may have received my newsletter if you live in my district, you follow me on Facebook or Twitter, but this was a significant piece of legislation I passed, the Driver's License Suspension Reform Act, which will affect thousands of people across the state. And simply, it makes people who are affected with getting fines and fees related to driving, they don't get their license suspended anymore. That's been huge for people of color, people who are poor. And let me just give you a scenario. You're driving down the street and you get pulled over because you rolled through the stop sign. And then they see that maybe your registration has been expired. Well, with each one of those tickets comes a fine and a fee. Well, maybe for many people who are on this Zoom, a $250 total bill is insignificant. Maybe it'll hurt a little bit, but I'll pay the total and just be done with it. But for a large swath of people across the state, $250 could be a million if you don't have any. And disproportionately, it has affected impoverished people, people of color, the communities of color. It's punitive. When the law was passed, they assumed that if you hit people hard and threaten them taking their driver's license away, people will pay. And that actually does not happen, hasn't happened. And what has happened is people just continue to drive with their license suspended. They're not paying their insurance. And this just says, you still have to pay. You know, you get those tickets, you still have a responsibility to pay. And there are infractions that happen if you don't. But no longer will those punitive damages come with having your driver's license suspended. And immediately, especially in places like Syracuse, where it's a transportation desert, you can't even get to East Syracuse easily on the bus if you wanted to, you know, enjoy some of those opportunities for work. A lot of people would be driving illegally. This says if you had failure to pay, you work out a payment plan, which is the best part of this, is that you can work out a payment plan based on how much income you have, and you have your license reinstated. So this was a huge win. We did pass this last year, and we did have a chapter amendment that we had to repass again this year. Next slide, please. This will be familiar to many of you, based on George Floyd's murder. Last year, we passed a significant package of police reforms. And many of you, because there were hundreds of you that attended the press conference that I put together last June, we passed a significant amount of police reforms that people have been clamoring for, that have been introduced for several years, that for many years have been ignored. And some of those that you can see, this was from the flyer that had went out. It's repealing 50A. Many people, that was the most significant bill that many people were talking about. And that's allowing the public to know any police misconduct. Records were always sealed. People never knew who the officers were and what their infractions were. This repeals 50A so that people, the public, us, we all get to know any kind of police misconduct. And that there's others on this list, the right to monitor police activity, having an oversight of police. If someone asks for medical attention under arrest, that they get that immediately. And all of these, you know, are relatable, that we've heard many instances across the country where any one of these things could have been pertaining to any kind of encounter with the police. Also banning racial ethnic profiling by police. It seems like we've been talking about that for decades, that we codified that in law. And some of the others we were talking about banning chokeholds. And it's a sensitive issue. There's a lot of, you know, tempers flaring, and this is not an anti-police package. It was a making sure that there is enforcement and accountability of laws, and making sure that the citizens of the state of New York have rights as it pertains to police encounters. Next slide, please. I would say some of the biggest bills that I have introduced as a package or via committee are tenant and homeowner bills. I have actually introduced more tenant bills outside of New York City than any other member. And some of them, as I said, have come from people who have come right from this this district to come to my office. This first one is relative to the property tax exemptions for people who live in a flood zone. So if you remember, then those who live on the east side of the city of Syracuse in that Meadowbrook area and that nice little brook that runs through, all of those people who live next to that are now in a flood zone. And there are areas in the south side of the city of Syracuse down by the creek, and they're in the 100-year floodplain, where it's going to take a biblical flood in order for that to raise to proportion, in order for that to flood. Well, all of those people who live in those areas have to have flood insurance, which is super expensive. So what we did was create a mechanism for property tax exemptions and for people who are required to participate in the program to only have to have minimal flood insurance equal to what they owe on their mortgage. That's not recommended. You know, obviously you would talk to your insurance broker, but you don't have to have the maximum amount the mortgage was worth. So say you took a mortgage for $300,000, you only owe $100,000. You only have to have flood insurance now to the minimum amount that you owe, which is $100,000, which is huge. And imagine the folks who live in a lot of these properties on the south side when we did the exemption, where they're on fixed income and now you have this huge bill for flood insurance. We were able to get them tax exemption. A certificate of occupancy. You know, we see what happened with the Skyline apartments. We see that across the community in the city where houses are not habitable. If you don't have a certificate of occupancy saying that apartment is inhabitable, then you can't have it. I think that's really important. People are living in squalor today around our community, and we have to be able to do better for the tenants and the renters in our community. So if you don't have that certificate, you're not allowed to have renters. Next slide, please. This is great. This came from the folks who I worked with over at Arise, being able to have individuals who are disabled to terminate their lease. Many times, you know, they're not able to live in their apartments anymore and may have to move to a different facility. Landlords wouldn't let them out of their lease. And then they had to pay for two different housing situations, many times not able to cover both. This allows people now to be able to get out of their lease if their doctor says they're no longer able to live in their apartment. So kudos to the folks at Arise and the disability community who sat with me and helped me craft this piece of legislation. Also, want to give kudos to the SU fellows for the flood insurance a piece of legislation, because that was actually a project they had at the Maxwell School. They sat with me. It took a couple of years to get this done. This mirrored a piece of legislation in Massachusetts, and we were able to get that done. And the next one is about able to deduct water bill payments from rent. This is something, again, that came from the tenant network. You would think that that's a no-brainer. You should be able to take away if you have to pay the water bill because your landlord didn't pay it and you shorted the rent, do the amount that was for the water so your water doesn't get cut off. Many times tenants were being evicted, given eviction notices, because they didn't pay the full amount of the rent. Now they're covered and that will not be cause for them to be evicted. Next slide, please. Relative to health, I have to say this was the number one issue when I was first elected in 2015. Anyone who lives on the east side, we had dear issues. I was able to bring money back the very first year to help with the east side in DeWitt for their Lyme management program so that they could manage how they wanted. There was culling involved on the east side to really kind of help the population on the east side, but we also created a working group for tick-borne diseases. You know, I think during this pandemic, we're thinking, oh, I can't be thinking about Lyme disease. I got to tell you, my husband had a tick on him last week. I picked one off my dog the day before that. So it has not gone away. And so we still need to be very diligent. So happy to be able to put that forward. And also this disruption for pre-authorizations. Interestingly enough, you would think that you say you have cancer and you are getting cancer treatments and maybe you need to get anti-nausea, you know, medication. And you would think that easily enough, your doctor would prescribe it and you would be able to get that treatment. Well, that pre-authorization, sometimes there was a disruption in service because they wanted you to get pre-authorized. And so this says, if it is relatable to your diagnosis, you don't have to wait for that pre-authorization. You can get that anti-nausea medication without having to wait and go through more pre-authorization with the insurance company. Next slide, please. Going over to the environment, many of you know that I sat on the Syracuse Industrial Development Agency, where many pilots were, you know, given out to different entities if they wanted to build buildings and, you know, create jobs in the community. And I said, maybe we need to be thinking about any new structure if they have energy efficiency, green technologies, rooftop energies, that we need to be thinking, you know, more towards the future, climate change, more renewable green technologies, that we need to, you know, give preference and benefits for those entities who are pushing the envelope and wanting to reduce their carbon emissions. So making that a part of the package that the applicants have to go through, and giving them exemption and consider that in their application. And also improving water saving performance standards. If you remember in the Obama administration, he actually had put forward different energy initiatives, which were overturned for 4 years. But we were able to make sure that the water standards that were the water sense standards that were put in place for the Obama administration for new water fixture technology was codified in law in New York, so that those standards for new fixtures have to be in place. Safety. This is an interesting one. This actually came from a sergeant from the Syracuse Police Department. There was an incident in the city of Syracuse where people buy the old police cars. You'll see them around a lot. Sometimes maybe they don't have the lights on the top, but it still looks like a police car. Still, you know, they still have the lights on the side sometimes. They'll still have the black and white painting, but maybe the logo isn't on the side. And there's been incidences where people have been pulled over, thinking that it was an actual police pulling them over, and it wasn't. It happened in Syracuse, where somebody was pulled over, dangerous situation, violent occurrence. So we, you know, put forward a law saying when a police car is decommissioned, it has to take all of the impressions off of it that make it look like a police car, so that in the future, and many times it goes to auction, and they presume that the folks at the auction locations will take care of that, and they don't. And you'll see these cars driving around our communities. Maybe you're on the thruway and it looks like the police is rolling up behind you, and it's not, because it's a car that someone bought at the auction. So we want to make sure that when people see the police, they know that it's an actual police car and not one that was just sent to the auction. Also, being able to allow background checks for mental health records in other states. Somebody moves here, we want to make sure if they had any record in a different state, we want to make sure that we have that information in New York if they are trying to access a firearm. We've already seen in this year the multiple instances of crime and gun-related violence, whether it's been mass shootings or individual shootings, even in our own communities, there's definitely been a rise of gun violence. So we want to make sure someone's moving here and has had a past mental health issue. Those records are available for review when people want to purchase a firearm. I wanted to just cover a couple of big pieces of legislation, which were not mine as a sponsor, but I was happy to be able to be a co-sponsor and vote for. So the first one is the adoptee reform legislation. Many of you may have seen my speech from the floor of the legislature, and many people actually think this was my piece of legislation because it personally affects me, even though it was not, and my plea was not for myself, but for others. But for over 80 years, being able to get your original birth certificate was not allowable. And so for many people, they never knew who their original birth certificate or who their original parents were. Now you can get your original birth certificate that has your birth mother's name. Perhaps it may have your birth father, but your birth mother's name and any relevant medical records that were included for your adoption. And this has been probably, and as I said, you know, the driver's license suspension was mine. I sponsored that bill, wrote it and sponsored it. But this bill, I was the first co-sponsor. And I have to say, I get more phone calls about this piece of legislation from people across the country and the globe. People call me and send postcards and emails and letters. And I was just on a Zoom 2 days ago with a group of people doing their annual lobby visit via Zoom. And this one gentleman says to me, I wanted to tell you in person, but since I can't, because there's no visitors allowed in the Capitol in the legislative office building, I just wanted you to know, because of that legislation, I was able to find my birth mother, and I have siblings, and I've been able to reconnect with them. And this just happened 2 days ago. There's not a month that goes by that I don't receive some correspondence from someone saying, you know, now I know. And it's up to them. You know, obviously you can decide to do it if you choose to or not, but this was historic to be able to move this forward. And I was glad to be able to participate actively in moving this legislation forward. The next one was related to the codification of Roe v. Wade and protecting reproductive health and rights for people in New York. That was a long time coming, but we were able to get that done in 2019. So I was happy to be a co-sponsor for that. And this year, happy to be able to co-sponsor the marijuana legalization legislation. Really, this is a landmark piece of legislation. It has disproportionately, and I know I had made mention of many things that disproportionately affect people impoverished, and especially our communities of color. This has single-handedly been one of the biggest issues that have impacted and criminalized low-income and people of color is our marijuana laws. And happy to be able to, this is a criminal justice issue, and happy to be able to right this wrong, and be able to, and we'll be putting this on actually in the next few months, an expungement event for people who had records of arrest that are covered in this current piece of legislation. Now they'll be able to get their records expunged. And you're talking about a whole community that has not been able to have, you know, gainful employment, that they've not been able to, you know, be active citizens in our community for low-level crimes that impact this community. So was happy to be a co-sponsor on this piece of legislation. And I wanted to go over, before we get to the questions, wanted to be able to go over the New York State budget, which we just passed last week, the week before. I have said to many people about this budget, that it's, I liken it to when maybe your grandfather millionaire dies and family members are then all fighting for the spoils of what your grandfather left. That to me is what this budget was like. We obviously received significant monies from the federal government, and this is all based on the pandemic. Significant monies from the federal government, also with the tax increases for the wealthy, we had a significant increase in our state budget. And there are many programs that many of you who've come to see me for the past 5 years, you know, have said that we need to cover, and, you know, our communities are ailing and failing in many ways. And we were able to get a lot of those things done. When no one is happy because something is missed, that means you may have got something right, because that means that everyone is equal at this point. So we were able to bring back record funding for education and finally meet the Campaign for Fiscal Equity and fully fund foundation aid, and we'll be up to fully funding that for the in the next 3 years. Many of you know, for the past 5 years, I had created the Southeast Gateway Initiative, where down in that southeast side of the city that includes south of Adams Street, that includes the Syracuse Educational Opportunity Center, the Syracuse Housing Authority, there's upstate in that swath of land, the Syracuse Community Health Center, that has been neglected for ages. And this was well before the decision was made of what was going to happen with 81. I said, this is my district. If there's anything I can do to be able to boost a community that has not been touched for decades, except for picking apart, you know, bits and pieces, I wanted to be able to make that happen. So we have near full funding for the renovations for SUNY EOC. That has been my pet project. Down in that neighborhood, I have given millions of dollars, and it's been spread around to the Housing Authority, to the Community Health Center, obviously to Mercy Works in the area as well. Upstate has, you know, received monies as well. So we wanted to make sure that along with whatever funding is going to come from the federal government relative to the I-81 project, that those institutions have been there and it's been a foundation of that community for decades, and we can't leave them behind. We have tenant assistance, huge amounts of money for landlords and renters and homeowners to get them back on track and make them whole. The diversity medicine program, I championed that program this year, wanting to make sure that diverse students are able to reach their medical school goals. And it actually increased, it got an increase in funding this year we were able to get. You see $800 million for small business, $40 million for arts recovery. We had money for, like as I said, the foundation aid. We have money for upstate transit, healthcare, environment, clean water, money, lots of money, you know, going around. And so I said, and I'll leave it at that because I want to make sure we get to questions. But I said to a couple of different leaders that with the amount of money that's come into our community. And that's just the state budget. Mind you, every municipality in our county has received money. The city has received like $126 million. The county has received $80 million. That's theirs. They do what they need to do with it. And they're still receiving, obviously, money from the state as well. Like I said, money's coming from everywhere. You know, it's like your rich grandfather, you know, spreading it around. But we want to make sure that with all of this money, and this is based on the pandemic, this is based on a huge disaster that has impacted our country. Stimulus, it's supposed to be able to move us forward. But if this money does not transform our community, so in a year's time, with all of this money flowing, and you know, in a year and 18 months, and seeing all this money rushing into our community, if we see that it hasn't been transformed in a way that we're moving in a positive upward trajectory that brings everyone with it, not just for the rich and not just for the folks who, you know, have those high paying jobs, but for the people who are in poor communities, so people who are living in squalor. If we are able to transform and move that forward, it really isn't about money. It's about leadership and vision and policy. And that's something that obviously would need to be addressed, because we're giving lots and lots of money. And we need to make sure that the people who have the least are brought up along as well. So with that, thank you. And I am open to any questions that anyone might have.
All right. Thank you so much, Assemblywoman Pam Hunter. So some questions have already started rolling in. So we'll get started. So the first question, can we have a service that checks in daily on people with disabilities or aging that live alone in the community?
I suppose we could have that service. You know, I think that there are definitely different not-for-profits and local organizations that do the best that they can in doing that. With every program, obviously comes people who need to run it and money that goes alongside, you know, with it. And I think that in some ways we are very service. We are a very service rich community. There are programs on top of programs on top of programs. I think that, you know, in many ways, instead of creating a new organization, maybe, you know, as they continue to meet and work together, I know the Human Service Leadership Council meets and gets together, that needs to maybe be a priority in saying, hey, with some of this new money that's coming in from the county, I know that they're cracking down on the skyline, maybe from that $126 million that's coming in from the federal government to the city, that maybe that's a possibility to be able to set up a check-in. We're talking about hundreds and, you know, thousands of people that need to be checked in on. And really, it's the responsibility of the people who own the building. Because there are people who are checking on the residents, you know, that, like I said, I deliver meals, that they have caretakers, but it really has been a safety and quality of life issue in the buildings that the people live in. And that absolutely is the responsibility of the people who own those buildings, not necessarily not-for-profits who are the caretakers of the people who live there.
Thank you so much. So next question, can you please describe what it's like to serve in the legislature with a Democratic majority in both chambers?
You would think that you would just get along all the time because everybody wants the same thing. But it's probably been more difficult this year than all of the 5 years before. And I say that because I don't qualify someone being a Democrat. If you say you're a Democrat, you're a Democrat. But people do have labels, and they do label themselves, whether they say I'm a socialist or I'm a liberal, or sometimes they say I'm a moderate or I'm a conservative. To me, a Democrat, you're a Democrat. And many times it's about wanting the same things, but it's also about the ways that we get to the conclusion, to the end, to passing budgets. And I would say it's been very difficult. It's difficult because of personalities, not difficult because of the budget or the pieces of policy that we want to put together. But really, I think the pandemic and not being able to be in person has impacted that a lot as well. But having the assembly has enjoyed a supermajority for several years, obviously the Senate has that now. We've not been in a position to have to override any veto by supermajority. But I do think, you know, taking a step back, there is something to be said about the needs and the quality of life of people who live in rural and non-urban settings than the folks who do live in like New York City. And the housing situation, it's the same, but it's different. And I think the voices of the people who represent the folks outside of the city need to be heard equally. And sometimes I feel like that gets drowned out. And so that'll continue to be a challenge. But for the most part, as you can see, we're passing legislation that really is impactful for residents of our state.
Thank you so much. So next question, how can you make sure that the disproportionate or the underserved communities receive their fair share of the stimulus money? Many of these folks don't necessarily have financial advice.
We put together, obviously, our budget based on the fact that we're trying to lift many, but that trickles down. I mean, obviously, it comes from the state level and it trickles down to agencies, to municipalities. It really needs to come from the local level to make sure that the delivery is happening. And as I have had, you know, the conversation, I did have this conversation with the mayor and, you know, and we'll have it with others. What are y'all doing with your money? You know, because it takes all of us to be able to lift folks together. And I know people like to see new buildings, and I repeatedly have said this, you know, people like to see new, and new, I guess, equals change, and new equals that, you know, we're being vibrant and things are booming. But if the wealth gap is not changed and has widened, even though we have new people moving into our community, but people are still so desperately impoverished, the new isn't necessarily helping the people who are needing it the most. And a perfect example is housing. So if you have a new building, you know, that's put up and said, well, we're going to make sure that a low income person can live there, and they charge maybe $700 for a one bedroom apartment. Imagine if you are a single mom and need, you know, an apartment, you're not going to be able to afford $700, because essentially we're saying 30% of your income is supposed to be the housing floor. Where's a $700 three bedroom apartment? That's what's necessary. We do not have affordable housing for people to live in. And until we make the policies for the folks who can't afford that minimum, it's unfortunate. That $700 apartment is really for a college student who maybe doesn't have a car, who is paying their student loans to be able to afford $700. Someone who is working as a CNA, and remember, we're not at $15 an hour. Our minimum is $12.50, even though many organizations are paying more. And sometimes people aren't working full-time. And that notion a lot of times, well, oh, at $15 an hour, at full-time, that's $30,000. People aren't working full-time at Burger King getting $15 an hour, and they're not getting benefits either. We need to be realistic and have the conversation about what people are really bringing home and making and where they can really live. If someone doesn't have stable housing, they're not going to have stable education. They don't have transportation. And this just keeps people being poor and keeping them impoverished. So, you know, my point is, hey, we're going to have a conversation. We're talking about affordable housing. Affordable needs to be affordable for the people who are the most poor. If you have somebody on disability and they're getting $700 a month, and they, you know, have some subsidy from the county, how do you live on the, and I've worked at a not-for-profit. I know what the folks have, $200 for the whole month on disposable income, $200. And that is supposed to go towards cable. It's supposed to go for your cell phone and food. And hopefully that supplements whatever you get in SNAP. It's unrealistic. People can't live like that. And when people do live like that, you see situations where you get the predatory buyers coming in and scooping up properties in our communities and not taking care of them. And that's where people live because they can't afford it. There's no running water. Someone called my office saying that there's no door handle on my back door. And what if there's a fire? And the landlord said, if you call codes, we're going to evict you. So these are the problems that we have, but it has to start at the local level.
Thank you. So next question, how can retired or unemployed older adults use our time, talents, and treasure to support the kind of transformation you just described and that we can all hope to see? This individual is a newcomer to Syracuse in 2018 and is thrilled about the stimulus money and how it promises to keep Syracuse Surge moving forward, as you say, for everyone's benefit and especially focusing on those who are and have been struggling.
There's any not-for-profit would welcome volunteers. Like I said, Meals on Wheels, you can volunteer every single day to either, you know, help make the food. And well, I don't know if you can help make the food now because of COVID, but go deliver meals. That is impactful, I have to tell you. When my mother was living, I would bring her with me and she'd want to sit there and talk the whole time to the people. I'm like, Mom, the people need their hot food. We got to keep moving. I would bring my son when he was like five, and they love to see the young people. You know, the Ombudsman program, they need volunteers all of the time. Imagine what we went through with the nursing home situation, being able to have more ombudsmen who are the relationship volunteers between the folks in the nursing home and the management and the families, being able to, you know, amplify the voice of the patient or the resident, rather, of the nursing home, if maybe family members aren't there. There's just a whole host. Just choose the things that interest you and find those organizations that deliver the service, because we desperately need people who are interested and want to help.
Great, thanks so much. Next question, will the state have a role in extending rent subsidies to more low-income tenants under Section 8 as more federal funds become available?
I don't know. Obviously, the amount of money that came through the federal and even the money that the state allocated really is for rent arrears for people who have not been able to pay their rent, for homeowners who haven't been able to cover their mortgage and maybe outstanding taxes. But, you know, we want to amplify and uplift people so they don't have to live in Section 8, you know, and it goes back to my point about affordable housing. If people, you know, had affordable places to live, they wouldn't need to, you know, be relying on the Section 8. So I don't know. A lot of that is with the federal government as well. And I don't know.
Thanks. Next question. Where are we with a healthcare system? Seeing how many people have come to be vaccinated for free gives a positive view of what a universal plan would look like. So many would have come because of no health insurance. So it seems like such a wonderful plan.
Everyone needs to be covered by health insurance. And we see many different countries, they have a universal plan. You know, whether people say Medicare, coverage for all, we have the New York Health Act, where, you know, our goal is to make sure that everyone is covered. If you dig down into the numbers, I do believe that they say that 90% of New Yorkers are covered by some sort of insurance, whether it's private insurance, whether it's Medicaid, whether it's Medicare. I did a constituent survey, you know, asking people if they're covered, and the majority of the people did say yes. A lot of the issue is relative to healthcare costs, especially with these high deductible plans. People are having to pay a lot of out of pocket. And I think we need to be able to have the question. It's not about, and I know a lot of times we'll see hashtags and sound bites and soapbox, and it sounds like a great idea. And I am a co-sponsor of the New York Health Act because everyone needs to be covered. They absolutely do. We need to have an open conversation and get everyone in the room. And it's uncomfortable. And I can tell you, having chaired the NCOIL, Health and Long-Term Care Committee, just this past weekend, I had two different people on opposite sides of the spectrum on one of the pieces of legislation, the models that was in front. And it was really uncomfortable. I said, wow, you know, this is not something that usually happens. And I have had pharma, I have had actuarial folks, consumer advocates, and actual doctors in one panel together. Hey, that's talking about, you know, none of these people agree. We need to be able to get the health insurance plans and, you know, the folks who are advocates for the single payer and hash out, what does this look like? How do you, as a commercial plan, all of a sudden we have this New York health insurance, what does that look like? So I want to be able to dig down for the sound bites, because that's where our heart is, but we need to know how logistically this is going to be rolled out, because every person does need to be covered. And in tune with, in concert with being covered, people need to have access to healthcare. Okay, you're covered, but you can't get a doctor's appointment. Okay, you're covered, but you want to have a telehealth appointment, but guess what? Your Wi-Fi doesn't work. And so you can't really, you know, have that video, you know, conference, telehealth appointment that you really need. So it's not just having the insurance, it's being able to have providers, having access to the healthcare that you need. And I think all of that conversation needs to happen more broadly outside of sound bites and hashtags, and bringing the parties together to say, how do we move this forward? And I get it. You know, I'm on the insurance committee, and, you know, that's, stockholders want to keep making their money. But we need to make sure our community is healthy as well.
Great, thanks so much. Can you please talk about the water infrastructure aspects of the New York State budget?
Well, obviously we have given, you know, considerable amounts of money to infrastructure, but all of those plans really come from municipalities. And unfortunately, I just picked up a bill that says it's like a single dig build. So if you dig in the ground for like new structure, if you're putting down cable, that you dig once and you replace the water lines down there as well. You know, I know for several administrations in the city, we're talking about billions of dollars. Billions of dollars didn't come to the city of Syracuse for infrastructure. Billions of dollars hasn't come from the state to the city of Syracuse. And then we're just talking about the city. We're not even talking about rural, you know, as well. And the federal infrastructure plan is supposed to kind of help and kickstart that. But if you're talking about infrastructure, meaning roads, but infrastructure with water, maybe you need to put the water down first before you fix the road. And I feel like we do a horrible job at that. And we're always digging up what was, you know, paved. The state itself does not, has not, cannot fully fund $1 billion plus to the city of Syracuse to be able to replace all of their infrastructure. But there are ways, as I said, with a single dig. So if there are plans in place to dig up highways, that we are replacing, you know, quadrants and roadways at one time so that we can get it done. You're not gonna be able to obviously dig up the whole city all at once, but there needs to be a plan in place.
Great, thanks so much. So going back to earlier this week with the historic guilty verdict for Chauvin, do you expect this to be an opportunity to push further legislation through on the New York State level with regards to police use of force and other such legislation?
This is really a tough issue. And, you know, I can turn my hat around and, you know, speak from the, you know, I'm a mom with a Black child and have had the conversation about what happens when you have a police encounter and what to do. And it's a hard conversation to have with your kid, you know, to say, you know, be respectful. And it's very difficult. It's very difficult. You can't legislate morality. You can't force people to be nice. And we need to do a better job in having policies in place to root out bad actors, policies in place to help with folks with mental illness, because that is on the rise, mental illness, overdose use, and what that looks like as far as police encounters. You know, I keep hearing training. Imagine, you know, all of the training that you're getting as a police and the encounter, and, you know, someone's coming in, a police officer with a gun, and they're, or they have a knife, and that's the training that they're getting. Well, civilians aren't getting training about what happens when someone's yelling at you, you know, yelling and screaming, put up your hands, and you're not listening and you're scared and you don't know what to do. We don't get trained for that. And you see, you know, you see the military weaponry and gear on, you know, police officers. That is a frightening situation. So it really needs to come down to how are we hiring, you know, law enforcement, and what is their role? Is it to stop crime, or is it to help after crime happens? Because really, if we don't take care of a lot of the foundational issues that I mentioned before about, you know, education and about apartment, you know, being people having stable housing and, you know, stable income, it's not going to change. You know, the rise of crime is happening. And then we keep seeing these encounters, and you watch the television with bated breath, like, I hope they make this decision, you know, right. Because I don't want to see a city burn. I mean, literally, you're thinking about this. And then on the same day, in a different state, in a different town, there's another police shooting. And, you know, we don't know everything that happened with that, but we have to do better. But, you know, if you have hate and racism in your heart and are thinking that poor people and people of color are lesser, then those people don't need to be on the police force. And I don't know how you root out racism out of a police establishment.
Thank you. A question related to that, how important is it to pass qualified immunity in the state of New York? Have you seen an increase in support given the guilty verdict we saw earlier this week?
Well, we'll see, because I have that bill. I have the bill to repeal qualified immunity. And, you know, many times people think it's relative to only law enforcement, but really it can relate to teachers. It can relate to any public employee. You know, we spend millions of dollars on lawsuits. And, you know, really, if you're thinking if someone is taking away a constitutional right of a person, and that's what, you know, qualified immunity, if you knowingly are taking that away, you know, you need to be held responsible. They just repealed it in New York City. These are bills that are introduced across the country. That is one of my priority bills for the remainder of the session. And hopefully by June 10th or whenever we finish, we'll be able to get that in.
Great. Thank you so much. Let's see. Next question. What is your position on Governor Cuomo's troubles? Should he step down, hang tough, or do you prefer to wait for the results of further inquiries?
I have been very consistent about this. Many people know, you know, obviously having been in the military, this is not a great you know, thing to be able to report, but I don't think that there was a day that I wasn't, you know, sexually harassed. And it definitely takes a toll. But having said that, also, I have been a human resource professional my whole entire career, obviously before I was an elected official. I have had to conduct investigations myself. I've taken complaints myself. And I do believe in process. I do. I will never negate someone coming forward. I do think it's very serious. Every allegation and someone's reporting something happening to them, if you have courage and you are able to bring that forward, or if it's within you to be able to want to speak up, I think that's very important. Every one of these people absolutely needs to be heard. But I absolutely believe in due process. I believe that the Attorney General has the power and disposal at her hand to be able to conduct this thoroughly and independently. The New York State Assembly has a Judiciary Committee that has convened, and that has the committee in place. They've hired attorneys and they are already hearing. They have a hotline that people can call if they have a complaint that they want to wage. And our committee is actually not only just looking into any allegations of, you know, sexual harassment or assault, but looking into the nursing home situation. I think it's the Mario Cuomo Bridge that they're looking into as well. So there's a host of things, but I will always believe in process. I hate that we're in this situation right now. I hate anyone harassing. I think it's despicable. And I know what it's like being in that position. But I have to tell you, in all of the time that we're going through the budget, the constituents in the state of New York, even though this is a lot of media fodder and very, very serious, people in the community were not calling about the governor. They were calling about, we need funding for our disability community. The number one call that we were getting during budget, we need money for schools. We need to make sure people have housing. And that's what the community is talking about. You know, we need to make sure this gets taken care of. Obviously, we need to have strength and leadership in our state. If it came up to a vote, given information, I'll make that determination at that time. But right now, I'm trying to make sure that I do the very best for my constituency. And I will leave that up to lawyers, which I am not, in order to investigate and move that forward.
Thank you. We have time for one more question. And I just want to say thank you from so many folks are putting in thank yous to you. So I want to pass those on to you for all your work. So last question, transportation to jobs is a giant wall. Are there any plans to help jobless folks get to and from work at the Amazon Fulfillment Center in Liverpool as an example?
There have been conversations specifically for the Amazon project with Centro and adding routes, trying to figure out what their schedule is going to be, if they're going to be, you know, a 24-hour operation, you know, if they're going to be able to extend those routes. We need to have, if we're talking about an infrastructure plan, and the 81 project should be able to help many ways and be able to expand routes, because really we have jobs, and that's one example, and that's a lot of employees, but there are many employers that don't have the thousands that Amazon is going to have that need, they need qualified people, they need people today to come and work at their organizations, but people can't get to work. They you know, if you're working a second shift, you're not able, maybe you're able to get there, but you're not able to get home and you don't have a car. And so, you know, we had put more money into transportation in this budget. That's going to help Centro immensely, but really, you know, hopefully with this, 81 project will be able to expand even more. And lastly, I want to say, you know, with our transportation system, many people who take it do it because that's the only transportation that they have. They don't have a car. They don't have means to take transportation. For a lot of folks who are like, I'm going to get on because it's a green, you know, clean energy things to do, you know, they'll hop on the bus and, you know, it's like, this is the best way to get to work, but they have alternative transportation. They have a car. You know, many of these people, you know, have ways to get to work and it's an option for them. For many people who are in poverty, they have no other option than public transportation. And, you know, when people say they, you know, all the problems with the MTA, I love MTA problems. That would mean that we have a huge, you know, complex transportation system and people are able to get, you know, outside of the perimeter of the city.
Great, thank you so much. Unfortunately, we are out of time. So on behalf of everyone in our audience, thank you so much, Assemblywoman Pam Hunter, for all of your work representing us and all your work on these different bills. And we look forward to seeing what you do in the future.
Thank you, everyone. It's been a pleasure to be here with you this morning. I appreciate having had the opportunity to be with you this morning. I interact with many of you, as I said, on either Facebook or Twitter or the newsletters that I send out and our constant contact emails where we have 6,000 email addresses that we're sending information to. So if you need anything, my office is always available to be of assistance. And I hope you all have a wonderful day.
Thank you.